I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On today's podcast, my guest is comedian, journalist, and all-round great talker, Ange Lafapierre. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I'm going to discover why her mother chucks rocks and shells at Big Squid. Great to have your company today, and it is equally great to finally catch up with the always fun and insightful Ange Lafapierre. We've been attempting to catch up for months now, like literally months, and we've finally made this happen, and hopefully we can get more of Ange on this podcast in the next few months. And, you know, to be honest, it also gives me a really good excuse to catch up with her on a regular basis. But she's always great, and this is no exception. So if you're a fan of Ange's work, keep an ear out because she plugs her upcoming shows at the Adelaide Fringe and Melbourne Comedy Festival towards the end of our chat. I also have a few shows coming up. I start my Adelaide Fringe run soon on the 28th of Feb. It's just around the corner. I'm doing 5 shows only. My new solo stand-up show, Little Victories. It's the first one since 2019. It's the first official one since 2019 anyway. And I'll be appearing at the Rhino Room. And because you're a loyal listener of Big Squid, you can access a discounted ticket by using the promo code PODCAST. Type that in. You can save yourself some coin when getting your tickets. So head to justinhamilton.com.au/gigs and you will be able to find more details. That's justinhamilton.com.au/gigs. And it's only 5 shows. So I know what happens during the Fringe because I have also been someone who has done this across multiple festivals where you think, yeah, I'm going to get to that, and you never get to it. Like, as an example, for ages I was planning on seeing The Picture of Dorian Gray and I kept missing it and it was my fault, and I finally managed to snare a ticket and I saw it on Saturday and it was fantastic, and I would have been really bummed out if I had missed this wonderful show. And what I'm trying to say is my solo show is as good as The Picture of Dorian Gray. Let's be honest, I'm going to be talking into a microphone and telling heaps of jokes, and that was a multimedia event. But anyway, you get the gist. So if you're keen to come along, 28th of Feb to the 4th of March, and then that's it, 5 shows only. Remember also, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you can use your super duper discount code for my solo show. And speaking of Patreon, when you sign up, you not only get access to really big discounts for live events, but you also get access to bonus podcasts, scripts, you get entry into our private Facebook group, so much more. And you also have an episode that is dedicated to you. And today's Patreon shout out goes to Alicia Hobson. Thank you for subscribing to Big Squid, Alicia, and being part of our thriving community. I think you'll enjoy this conversation with Ange, who is never anything less than entertaining. So let me know what you think once you've heard this episode. If you're not a subscriber and would like to join us, and all money that goes into the Patreon goes into the production of this podcast, head over to patreon.com/Justin Hamilton and you can find a tier that suits you. I'll be back at the end of this podcast to let you know what is coming up later in the week and what is also starting up next week. But for now, let's bring in our good friend, Ange. About 6 months in the making, this podcast. I feel like we have genuinely been trying to do this for about 6 months, and I reckon there was scheduling.
Yep.
So there were times where our schedules just weren't meeting up,
mm-hmm.
and then you were overseas,
mm-hmm.
and then you came back, and then you were all over the place.
Illness struck.
From being overseas.
Yeah, we won't go into detail.
So it's finally happening, which is great. And also, I'm glad that you've come in with some notes, because I, from about October, had a little thing of notes for you, and then I added to it, and then I took stuff out because it wasn't relevant, and then I lost them.
Yeah, great.
So,
well, perfect. I mean, I'll lose these later today.
Yeah.
Like, these have about 3 hours left before I lose them. So, yeah, look, I mean, it's been 6 months in the making. I mean, some films get made quicker than this podcast episode got made.
Right, I know.
And I think, you know, that'll be reflected in quality. The amount of time that it's taken for this to
this
come
is going
together.
To be great.
Yeah.
It'll be good. I feel very confident. Have you been going to the cinema lately, or have you been a TV person?
I have been taking my new kind of, like, I've sort of rebooted my career in the last year as a culture journalist more mm-hmm. than I've sort of moved away from hard news, and I cover like culture and trends and like the internet now, which I'm loving. And it also means that I've just had to change my media diet a lot.
Yep.
So what I read, what I consume every morning changes, and I've got like a rolling weekly list of like things to consume, and that might be podcast, TV, you know, that's changed really dramatically. And heaps of like current TV and film has which I just didn't have time for before, is now like kind of a professional imperative to watch, which is such a cool professional imperative to have. And I feel like you have that as well.
Yeah.
And so I have some things to discuss. I now all of a sudden have thoughts about
Andor,
about White Lotus. Anyway.
Yeah. It's funny. I have moments of talking to my friends, and especially friends who have kids as well, any age. And you'll be talking to them about something, and they'll say, "Oh, I haven't even heard of that. What's that on?" And you'll say, "Oh, it's on Disney Plus." "Oh, no, we don't have Disney Plus." And I'm like, "Why don't you have Disney Plus?" Or, you know, they won't have Stan, or they won't have. And then I have to remember, oh, yeah, that's right. No, I'm the weirdo who has to be across all of these things to be able to kind of check in. And, you know, you're not going to be across everything, but you need to be able to have the option.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I mean, you know that you've got to like subscribe to everything now, and we have this incredibly fragmented internet that we didn't used to have. And so now you kind of, I reckon if you're a parent with this kind of inflation, you're just like, okay, you know what, the kids are watching the ABC, and that's what they're watching. Yep. That's free.
I know they're 17, but they can still get something out of Bluey, so that'll be fine.
Well, famously, they apparently can. I'm yet to watch an episode. That is somewhere at the bottom of my to-consume list.
You know what? People who bang on about Bluey can be almost evangelical, like Craig Egan.
Yeah, it's like a weird cult, isn't it?
You watch it and it's great.
Yeah, no, I know.
And I reckon it's because there's so much shit kids stuff that when you get something good, you become a bit hysterical.
Yeah.
Oh, I can get into this as well, you know.
Yeah, I feel like people are just like, we can serve up any old thing to kids and kind of forget that they're actually incredibly discerning. But but maybe, I don't know, maybe like Bluey was the first great kids TV item in a while.
For a while. It feels like it. I don't know enough, but it feels like, you know, the only times I've ever really seen children's television is on a regular basis is back when I used to go on the road a lot.
So yeah.
You'd be like on road show. So you'd get up in the morning, you just turn the TV on, so you've got something
to kind of
keep you know, buzzing in the background. And sometimes you'd look and you'd be like, I'm about to have an epileptic fit. Like, how are kids dealing with this?
I just remember my mum and dad always banging on about how much they loved play school and me not getting it until I was old enough for them to explain to me that there were all these Easter eggs for adults in play school where, you know, like, I don't can't remember their names. Like, let's say it's Monica and Pete. Those are like play schooly names. Yep. And, and you know, Monica would be like bashing on some pans as part of the game. And Pete would be like, ow, 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 no, my head. And then he'd be like, "What? Wait, what's wrong, Pete?" Pete'd be like, I've got a sore head today. Like, bright lights hurt my eyes and loud noises upset me. And like, the gag is Pete has a hangover. Like, there are all these weird. And sometimes apparently, I've not verified this. Do not quote me. Never quote me. But there was like weird sexual innuendo.
Really?
Like, but not concerning kids or anything like wrong like that. But just like stuff like maybe like some flirty vibes between the, I don't know. Yeah. I feel like my mum and dad, when they were reflecting this back to me, so this is like 6th, 10th hand, which is why I'm like, don't quote me.
Right.
But they were like, no, there was all these, there was all this cool stuff in play school for adults.
That's funny. I have not heard any of that because mum was not into play school and I wasn't in it for long either. Like, I think I went straight from Sesame Street to mum discussing the dismissal.
This was also like the yeah, right. This was always like the early, also the early 90s when my parents were watching this and it was Forbes, which for people who don't know is like kind of like fewer than, it's like a four-figure town.
Yeah.
Like there's, you know, I don't know how many people, I'm pretty sure it's one of those towns that's shrinking and it's in sort of country New South Wales and that's where I grew up. And so like, they probably just hadn't, like, no one had told them a joke in like 6 weeks.
Right.
And then, and there was no internet and the cinema didn't exist. And so, like, they probably, like, literally there was like this one thing on play school and they were like, that's hilarious. And so they've got like an like this totally disproportionate bond to play school. And maybe it, like, they made like 2 jokes for adults in like 5 years, but my parents remember both of them.
And I reckon that's what's happening with Bluey.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The adults are centering on it because it's the one thing they can center on because everything else is too much.
Hungry shark. Or, I don't know. I'm not going to try and make like references to kids' culture because it's like a total blind spot for me and I'm that's fine.
And
I'm comfortable
relief.
With that. I'm comfortable.
What an absolute relief that it is a blind spot.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything recently that's blown your mind?
Yeah. Okay. So I really need to talk to you because I feel like as a sci-fi person, is that the preferred title?
Yeah, why not?
I feel like calling people like geeks and nerds is now cool again. Like being a geek, being a nerd is now back in.
Yeah.
And I wonder if your community still experiences that as a slur.
I have no idea. I don't belong to any community. like, sure. I'll just answer.
Okay.
Look, to be honest, when it comes to words, it's not the word, it is the intention.
Because people are now claiming, like, because now there's like these weird little, because fandom is so like toxic and by its definition exclusive, right? You know, I think there are nice versions of it, but when it extrapolates, particularly in an internet environment, that's how it ends up.
Yeah.
And so you now have like people gatekeeping what it is to be a geek / nerd, whatever, because you've got people like, you know, like what I would say is like conventionally attractive women, like hot girls on the internet, how like a certain type of person on the internet would classify particularly men, like, oh, all these like hot women suddenly claiming to be like a geek or a nerd because it's cool all of a sudden. Well, show me your credentials. Anyway, that's what I was alluding to when I said that that's suddenly cool again. But look, I'm interested in your take on Andor in particular because I finished, and I know I'm a little behind here.
That's
so bear with me. But I finally finished watching the season, that season of Andor.
Yeah.
The only season. Last night. And
so it's fresh.
Yeah. So I want to talk about it. And and basically, obviously spoilers here for people who've not seen it, but I mean, it is quite emotive all the way through. There are it's incredibly well done. I'm not the first person to say that. The dialogue is really believable and excellent. And also it's like fabulously anti-fascist and so much stuff going on. Anyway, there are a lot of points throughout that season where one with a heart in one's chest might cry.
Yes. Yes.
However, I didn't. And I, like, I'm not, you know, I'll cry and things like that's not a, that's not an uncommon occurrence for me. However, it wasn't until the final episode that the waterworks really turned on.
Okay.
And the moment that it happened was when this robot, this droid, is mourning the death of this matriarch, of Andor's mother.
Yeah.
And you know, you get like a POV shot from the droid and it's like everything's shaking, the world's shaking. Yeah. You kind of have like almost like a watery view. It's like evoking like being a droid and tearing up and like shaking from your grief.
Yeah.
And like obviously in the Star Wars universe, droids are not your standard robot. Like droids are given this emotional depth.
Yeah.
From what I've seen.
Yeah.
You know, that it's never fully explained because you don't have to, because that's the benefit of sci-fi. But like they just kind of give droids feelings without ever explaining why. But they only to a certain extent. We're almost to understand that droids have a muted half emotional life, like something like that, and a deep loyalty, almost like a dog.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that's the world. And people, I know people will dispute and say like dogs have full emotional lives. I can just hear that now. But anyway, so let's say, you know, a kind of lesser version of human emotionality.
Yeah.
And I just broke up completely.
Yeah.
Maybe it's to do with something else that I'm going through that I'm not even aware of yet. Maybe it like unlocked something in me. But
right.
I just wondered if you'd ever had any experiences of like robots having feelings, machines having feelings, anthropomorphized machines having feelings, just killing you emotionally because that was, it got me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So long-time listeners of this podcast know that we do a podcast called Space, or a section called Space Podyssey, where we go over old films. And the first movie like that that ruined me was a film called Silent Running, which is about all of the world's ecosystems have been put onto spaceships and that they've had to eject them from the Earth to save them. And then the corporations running them decide that they can't afford to keep them anymore and they're just going to destroy them. And there's these three little droid robots who are nicknamed Huey, Dewey and Louie. And they are just little boxes with feet that go around planting and doing all sorts. And it is a lot.
Yeah.
And when we rewatched the movie, you know, parts of it's quite dated. You know, it's from 1972, I think, off the top of my head. But the robots in that are like, so they had people inside them who were, from off the top of my head, I think a couple of amputees who were on their hands, you know, acting out the robots. So they kind of, even though they're quite mechanical looking, there is sort of something about the way they move that is relatable.
Yep.
And it was that. And then there was a Disney film called The Black Hole, and there was Bob and Vincent, and they were sort of like the same makes, but Bob was all battered. And I think this is kind of what relates to what you're talking about in Andor with B2 Emu, who is, he's battered and he's seen
lived.
A lot.
He's lived
a life.
Yeah.
And he's loyal. Like he's like a dog.
Yes.
You know,
Very dog-like.
And none of this surprises me.
Yeah.
Like he's devastating.
What do you think it is, though, about...
And he's not quite shown the affection that you want him to get either.
No.
Which also makes it worse.
Yeah, and it adds a really interesting ethical dimension to the whole thing where, like, the values of that series are, like, anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, on a very literal level.
Yeah.
Like, it's anti-capitalist. Like, there are a lot of, like... It is a hugely radical series in many ways.
Yeah, and in Star Wars, of all things.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really thought it was a very interesting choice to add this kind of complexity to these people, these main characters whose values and who you're just meant to endorse. You're meant to go, these are the good guys, to give them this kind of behavior, to endow them with this practice of treating this droid as lesser.
Yeah.
Adds this very like beautiful complexity to them where you're like, oh, I don't actually, or you're not perfect either.
Yeah.
And it would be so tempting. And I think it is often a trope, right, in science fiction in particular, where the goodies and the baddies are fairly rigidly defined. I mean, Star Trek being an exception to that.
Yeah, yeah. There's complexity in other things. But yeah, I know what you mean, especially in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, like, so it is known for, it has that reputation, doesn't it?
And that's why kids love it.
Yeah.
Like everyone forgets it's, you know, it's family entertainment.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, Cassian is an interesting character because you actually see the burgeoning of having a sense of, you know, responsibility to something greater than him throughout the 12 episodes, is it? Yeah, I think it's 12. Yeah. So, like I enjoy The Mandalorian. Once again, Baby Yoda was one of those things that I saw as a meme first. Mm. And I was like, I'm like, oh, fuck off. I'm not watching this. I'm like, Baby Yoda, you're just trying to sell more toys. And then I watched it and that puppet stole my heart. I, I love it. I love it. They've done a really good job with it. But
you've got to admit it. When it's got you, it's got you.
Yeah, and let it happen as well.
Yeah,
like, don't fight it. Just go, great.
Who wins if you fight it?
Well, you know, lots of people, like I was, one of my favorite things to watch in the world is I watch the NBA basketball, and because it's not broadcast in, like, I'm not getting the American broadcast. I'm watching it from the app. So that means it doesn't go to adverts. Sometimes they just show what's going on in the stadium. And in the stadium, because they have those big shot clocks and screens, they'll do things like they'll have kiss cam or they'll put bongos up. And if you see yourself, you know, you play the bongos or you have a little snog or it's a dance cam or whatever. And I find them hilarious and I really enjoy them, and it's one of the things that I love about Americans is that they could be sitting there watching their team eat a bag of shit and then they see themselves on the big screen and the next minute they're like and they perform and everyone cheers and it's really funny. And in the rare times somebody doesn't perform, you can see people booing them for not getting into the spirit of it.
Yeah.
Or even my favorite thing is someone kind of just lost miles away and seeing it at the last second, and before they launch into it, it's already moved. Anyway, I just find it really entertaining.
Yes.
And I like that more than Australians, in that I think in Australia, if you do that, you know, people are more likely to be rubbing their balls on their mate's ears or flipping the bird, you know, because they don't want to, because it's not cool.
Yeah, but
that's what I like about it. That's one of the traits of Americans I like, that they just get into it. Anyway, I showed a friend and they were just like, oh, stupid fucking Americans. So I was like, you just missed everything that I was saying.
This is
the best part of being American.
Yeah. Let yourself love the thing.
It's
like,
okay.
You're on the side of, like, even if you think that it's a little bit basic, let yourself love the thing. Let yourself cry at the robot's grief. Let yourself find Baby Yoda cute.
He's cute.
Yeah.
What can I say?
Okay. So on the cuteness thing as well, I feel like that got, like, okay, so what I know I'm circling back here, but with, I wondered if you knew or if you had any thoughts on why it is we find robots' sadness more compelling, or why I might have found a robot sadness more compelling than like a human's grief, like why that was like the gateway to tears.
Well, I feel like it's because there's something like animals. I feel like there's something innocent to it. You know, it's the, you know, the, like the awful stories about someone dying and the dog sitting next to the grave and never eating again and dying next to the grave.
Yeah, this thing,
like it's reduced to basic core emotional stakes that we would all like to have in a certain way. But we're complex, you know, we're full of caveats. We're full of thinking our way through things. But this was just the robot loved its master and is sad that the master's gone and is still loyal, and that's beautiful. Yes.
And I think that's a film that's like the sort of screen logic of it, but I find it really interesting because dogs and robots, if are anything but innocent in real life, they lack the moral framework, like the ethical framework that humans tend to operate with. I understand.
But that's
what
the innocence is.
Yeah.
Like a dog just loves you.
There's nothing to stop the dog from like eating you if you... Do you know what I mean? Like dogs are... dogs are an interesting example because we have domesticated dogs.
Yeah.
But then you have the foundation of like what a dog is, and the dog doesn't care. Like it is still an animal that will like bite and kill potentially, depending on how the individual dog obviously and how well it's trained. But the fundamentals of what a dog is. And okay,
but a dog's loyal to you, and if you drop dead, and if the dog's starving, it'll eat you.
Yeah.
Right. But if we're on an island and I drop dead, like you should eat me, but you...
I feel like the dog won't think as hard about it as I would think about it, though. Do you know what I mean?
I reckon I'd be pretty tasty. So I feel like a little saute hammer would be delicious.
My alternative yes, my alternative theory as to why I potentially found that more moving, why one might, is that it is like a safe way.
Dogs,
robots, they're like us, but they're not us, and we can recognize enough of ourselves. It's like a safe distance from which to regard a really big emotion. It's like watching the blast through binoculars.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're like, the safety, your safe distance from it is what allows you to kind of feel it more fully.
Yeah.
Because if you relate to, like, you know, a son losing his mother, that is altogether too real.
Yeah.
Whereas the robot losing its master, or the robot losing its, you know, beloved, you know, that's, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
That's my napkin psychology.
Yeah, I think there is a level of safety to it. Like, you know, you're also talking to a 50-year-old man who is quite comfortable not being in a relationship, but has a bear over there from 2013 that he saw on a table in a common air rubbish room, and saw it there for like 3 days in a row, and thought, you know what, you better come and live with me. So,
yeah.
Cleaned him up.
Yeah.
He's been happy ever since. Look at him.
How'd you clean him up? Did you take him to the dry cleaner?
No. I just got some water and some soapy water and a sponge and just cleaned him up.
Yeah, right.
And he's great.
Yeah.
He's been very happy ever since. Look at him. He's got a whole lot of pals.
I'm looking at him. Hey, buddy. Hey. Can I also...
I think they did a good job with that robot as well. You know, it kind of is treated a bit robots.
Maybe cruelly. Maybe you wouldn't feel it for every robot.
Yeah. Like there's other robots that explode throughout the series that you don't blink at, but that one's battered and it's devoted and, you know. And then there's just Cassian shows it just a little bit of love towards the end, and I think that's almost like, that's just really good storytelling. You go, great, good work, Cassian.
Yeah.
Letting it go away with them.
I have to say, it left me with a lot of questions about, like, the pro, and like, no doubt on like various like fan wikis on the internet, there is this information will be out there, but like the Star Wars lore on the programming of droids, like what it is they feel like, what we're, because I mean, people are like famously loyal to that franchise, obviously, and there would be that detail exists. That detail does exist somewhere, and people would have walked into, you know, that series having expectations of what droids are capable of feeling.
Can I also say, I have seen R2-D2 and C-3PO in 9 Star Wars movies, and if I saw them blow up, I'd be fine.
You'd be fine.
Yeah.
But...
And R2's great, and C-3's hilarious, but if they got blown up, you'd be like, oh, fundamentally, man, I can't believe they just did that.
They're comic relief, though, aren't they?
I guess, that doesn't necessarily mean you can't feel empathy towards them. But I just think they do a much better job with the robot in Andor.
That actually brings me to the other thing that I wanted to seek your screen wisdom on, which is basically deaths and what makes a funny death.
Oh, before we get into that, what was and rightfully so, everyone talks about the language in Andor and the speech that Stellan Skarsgård gives about, you know, he's burning his present for a sunrise he'll never see, and like, it's
holy shit, that was amazing.
You're sitting there and you're going, fuck, what is happening here? Like, I've never heard dialogue like this in anything from Star Wars. This is magnificent,
sparkling.
I could have done a whole hour of watching Cyril try to eat his cereal while his mum berates him. Like, I could have done a whole spin-off series of him just trying to go to work and his mum just telling him off.
Yeah, I love that they put those characters in there. It was a little bit like, it was also like a very bold move from the writers. I thought, he did fuck all for 7 episodes except eat cereal.
Well, he got in trouble.
Shit.
He got in trouble at the start. Like,
I remember. No, but like, he got in trouble. He had like a big thing. And then he was just like, there was just like at least like 2 scenes in every episode for about 7 episodes, for like the bulk of the season, where he's just eating shit, getting told off by his mum, and eating cereal. Those are the 2 activities that he does, and he just gets beat up.
Magnificent.
And we love it. Yeah. He's this sad clown. He's a sad clown. And the mother is like polarizing, but mostly beloved, I think.
She's so good.
Yeah.
She's so good.
For being evocative, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
I was into all of it and every storyline. And I was never unhappy to be in whatever storyline I was in, I was like, great.
I've also never had a favourite fascist before. I realised like two episodes in that I'm like,
yeah.
the commander in the ISP, the intelligence commander, I'm like, yep. Wow, I'm actually really rooting for her. I'm in her corner.
Well,
I kind of want good things for her.
Well, because she's coming along and she's obviously smart and she's right. She's being treated like a bucket of shit, and you go, fucking men, the way they treat women. Even yes. In this fucking, in a galaxy a long yeah. time ago, far, far away, this woman's being treated like shit. So I was rooting for her as well. And then she started torturing Bix, oh, yeah, and I went, that's right. No, she's awful. Yeah. Hang on a sec.
Yeah, and you had to do it.
Once
real
again,
180.
Good storytelling.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. I think, I feel like she's like the emblematic, I don't know if you're across like girl boss discourse.
No.
Okay, so girl boss is a very, I feel like she is the girl boss.
Okay.
She's the original girl boss. She's emblematic of the fact that girl bosses have fallen from favor. So girl boss is a term that was like a bit of a rallying cry throughout the 2010s, basically like the millennial era where millennials were kind of driving the culture, capital T, capital C, and internet culture in particular. And it was this upswell of feminism, but the version of feminism is one that's often critiqued as like quote unquote white feminism, like
right.
and that's not even specifically encompasses race, but it's basically saying like your feminism is basic and doesn't take into account like different kinds of
right.
privilege and different kinds of, not to get too bogged down in this, but like it was basically like a frustration that emerged, and a really valid one. That, you know, we were spending a lot of time worrying about women succeeding in boardrooms mm-hmm. when there were more pressing issues facing all kinds of women with who weren't just white women right. and women who were not rich women and women yeah. who were not, you know, university educated necessarily. And yeah. it was like, it's basically a conversation about intersectionality. And the girl boss became a bit of a sacrificial lamb here. Now it's gone from being like a rallying cry
yep.
for women, like yay girl boss, to being kind of a slur.
Right. Okay.
And that like, and it, you might remember, say, the debate around Hillary Clinton, and you know, some people on the left, like center left, saying, "Oh, it sucks that we didn't get like a female president," and then a whole bunch of people from further left on that spectrum going, wait a second, like she was involved with some pretty shady stuff in the Middle East
yeah.
and that, you know, like we don't agree with her politics and we are not surely we are not so hard up for success and we are not so basic as to celebrate all women no matter their ethics and values. We can still
yeah.
choose. We are not we are not such beggars that we cannot choose.
Yes. And then you had some women arguing that, you think that's a fair argument, and then they voted for Trump and you go, what?
I don't know that very many people switched from Hillary to Trump, but I'm sure there were some out there.
I don't know. Like, I feel like yeah, there was...
That's true. Actually, there was analysis about suburban women and that was how Trump got in.
Like, it
there.
Was... Anyway. But yes. So, but
Mira is like the girl boss. It's like the, you know, it shows you... It's a bit of a mirror for yeah. that, so to speak. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mirror. Anyway, yeah. Okay, I'll move on. sorry, it's real happening in real time here, where you go, oh, I want her to succeed. And that is basically on the basis of gender.
Yeah.
And that she's like, and she's getting like harassed by, you know, the creepy guy who got fired, who yeah. worked up being a bureaucrat. Like,
Kyle MacLachlan's evil clone.
Right. The cereal eating dude. And you're like, oh, like leave her alone. She's a woman yeah. trying to succeed. And you're like, wait a second, what the hell am I cheering for?
Yeah.
She felt like the mascot for the fall from grace of girl bosses. And
yeah.
that here ends my TED talk on girl bosses.
No, I enjoyed it. I'm really into it. You know, I'm getting quite frustrated in recent times of I've had a few friends who, you know, like old friends as well, who will say things to me like, oh, you won't be interested in this because it's about girls. And you go, what? what?
Do you mean it's about 50% of the population?
But also,
52 or something.
You've known me for decades.
Yeah.
I watched Julie and Julia. You know why? Because I really like Meryl Streep and Amy Adams. Like, that's why I watched it.
Not because you like Woody Allen? Wait, was that Woody Allen?
No.
Oh, okay. No. I'm thinking of something else.
No, yeah. I watched it because it's
I'm thinking of
Amy Adams
Vicky,
and
Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
No, yeah. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
No, I don't need to see that.
Julie and Julia. Yeah.
No. But, you know, it's like, I saw...
It's a dig. It's a real... It is a dig, whether or not they mean it as such.
It's absolutely a dig. But there's also... It's like, I feel like I'm just about to say, oh, you won't like this. This is about black people. Just to upset them. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, because it's as ridiculous or...
Yeah, tell me you think I'm a racist without telling me you think I'm a racist.
Well, I don't know where this has come from, you know, this sudden... And it's happened quite a bit over the last 6 or 7 months.
Well, what I would say is I think that there is a collective exhaustion. I'm working on a second season of a podcast I make called Schmeitgeist, which is about trends. It's basically, it's like Schmeitgeist, Zeitgeist, it's about what's in the zeitgeist.
Mm.
And we're trying to work on something, and I'm still organizing my thoughts on it, but basically post-woke.
Right.
Right, where I think there is like a collect, and this is like very much being driven by Gen Z, but it is across the board as well. And it anti-woke falls into this too. There's like anti-woke movements, but there's like a post-woke thing where, whether or not this is true, there's an assumption that people are exhausted with certain debates around identity. And like if they were going to get the point or agree or both, that's already happened.
Yeah.
And the repetition becomes tiresome if we're not advancing solutions, if we're just sort of talking about, you know, different iterations of injustice of that shape or kind.
Yeah.
Then, okay, like, who does this help? Who does this serve?
Mm.
And maybe that's a little bit, maybe what you're experiencing there, I'm being quite kind to your interlocutor who you have not named, but perhaps there's like an people anticipating that, going like, oh, we're all bored of these conversations.
Oh, yeah. But yes. Oh, yeah. No, I see the point you're making. But the greater point I'm making is you've known me for decades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why are you saying it to me?
Yeah.
Like when have you ever said anything to me and I've gone, oh, fucking women, like, you know.
You do that to me all the time.
I've heard you say that before, I just do anything to make you laugh. Yeah. Like, you know. Anyway, it's just one of those frustrations where it's like, I'm right here. You know, I saw the most magnificent movie on the weekend with probably, like, one of the best performances. Like, I'm trying to work it out. I'm so far down this Warren hole at the moment. One of the best performances I've seen in the last 10 years. And it's Cate Blanchett in Tar.
Oh, yeah. And well, yeah, no, I've got to watch that still.
Oh,
yeah.
It's...
Yeah, yeah.
It's out of control. I watched
the trailer and you can see how great she is from the trailer.
I know. But yeah. I would love to see Michelle Yeoh win the Oscar because it's Michelle Yeoh.
Sure.
And, you know,
who doesn't but love that film
if Cate
all,
Blanchett
yeah.
doesn't win, it's a fucking travesty. Like, she should win... Best Actress and Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress and Best Supporting
she
Actor.
She should win next year and the year after.
Like, it's out of control.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm so excited to see it.
And I'm reluctant to bring it up with some people because, you know, it's like I went and saw that movie because I heard it was good and because I think she's great.
And you don't want it to be – I had someone who came back to me the other day and they were a little bit kind of like – they'd seen Everything Everywhere All at Once, but they'd seen it like – whatever, 9-12 months after everyone else saw it. I can't remember when it came out. Yeah. And it had been hyped so much to them that they're a bit like, well, it's not like it didn't change my life.
Well, a movie doesn't have to change your life.
It doesn't have to change your life to be good, but it'd been overhyped.
I do understand something being overhyped.
Yeah.
But anyway, whatever. All right, what's the... sorry.
Oh, I was going to... Okay, we can quickly... I have thoughts on the menu as well. Have you seen the menu?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because everyone complained bitterly about the menu.
Same.
Yeah.
I had the same thing happen to me. What was the complaint coming your way?
Okay, and I happen to share some of the gripes, but the thing is that I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop thinking about that room. I can't stop thinking about the premise.
Yeah.
I think it's an incredibly good premise that was quite poorly executed because, okay, first of all, I think it's cashing in, so to speak, on the Eat the Rich thing, that Eat the Rich pattern in screen culture at the moment, where there's a whole raft of things that have just done incredibly well over the last few years, whether that is Squid Game or whether it is White Lotus or whether it's, I don't know, there are so many Eat the Rich films, but you know, films that essentially had like
you mentioned two TV shows.
Two TV shows, screen culture in general. I feel like there's like a blurring line between like the higher end of TV.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of, I feel like the budget per minute is fairly comparable to a lot of, to a lot of cinema that's made now. And then you've also got Netflix and like, you know, actually making films, making feature length films. So it's an incredibly blurry universe now. So yeah, I do kind of just lump it all in as screen culture. But yeah, what I would say about the menu is I felt to me like some executive somewhere had said, we need a film that critiques the rich, but not in a way that's going to be uncomfortable for anyone. We want to, they all talk like this, film executives talk like this. we want to do it in a way that, that feels like people are going to walk out of the cinema and kind of like pat themselves on the back and like feel a little bit smug, like, no, I'm not one of those like foodie, pretentious foodie assholes, but not actually really have their politics challenged in any real way. Okay, so for starters, you have this unhinged chef who has like, you know, flipped out and has decided to kill. Okay, so we know, but his rationale, you are drip fed his rationale for killing everyone.
Yeah,
and it doesn't. I don't believe it for a second. Like, that's like, you made a movie, like the shitty actor, like the washed up actor, where it's like, you made a film once that reminds me of, what was it? It was like, it reminds me of how bad art can be or something. And so right. I'm going to kill you. It's like, no, man, there are so many reasons. Like, there were so many better candidates to have in that room to kill. It just, no one was really that believable. I think it's a strong premise, excellent premise. And I'm obsessed with the fact that they put it all in, pretty much held the whole thing in one room.
Okay.
I love that. Yeah. I can still remember that room. I could like draw that room with my eyes closed. It's like, it's etched forever in my memory.
Yeah.
But it jumped the shark, lost me. The characters stopped being believable. The dialogue stopped being believable. It's pretty, you know, early on in the film, like a third of the way through.
Right. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah, you just thought it was funny.
I just thought it was really well made and it was funny.
Yeah.
Like I don't give a shit about food culture.
Oh, no, I wasn't offended.
No.
It didn't go harder. Oh. I wanted it to go harder.
I don't know. Like I've got to be honest with you. Like one of my favourite scenes in a movie from last year was when Nicholas Holt was forced to cook.
Yeah, that was pretty nice.
And there was a part of me, I was sitting there, like, you know, you always bring a little bit of yourself to a movie. I was sitting there going, fuck, man, I would love to have done that to a couple of punters over the years. Yeah, all right, get up, mate. Go on, entertain a room. Go on, mate.
Yeah.
Let's see you go. Yeah. Go for it, mate.
I have seen people kind of do that.
Have you?
Yeah. Well, oh, not like give him the mic, but like be
never
like.
Give him the mic.
No, never. Well,
it's a terrible mistake.
I don't know. I would like to, let's say I would watch that scene in a film quite happily to be like, what happens? I would like to write that scene.
Oh, yeah.
To be like, what are the possibilities here? What happens when you, because you know, I've stopped sometimes because I don't actually have, I'm not that kind of comic.
Yeah.
If someone goes me, which rarely happens actually, because I kind of play pretty low status on stage, relatively low status most of the time. And
you talk quickly too.
Maybe they're not keeping
which is
up.
Good.
I don't know. Yeah. But they, I don't know. But like, it's, I don't feel like people haven't gone me very often. And when they have, it tends not to be nasty. It tends to be that like sort of well-meaning, I think I'm contributing, but I'm just not, I just haven't seen enough comedy. Yeah. You don't mind that. You just kind of like try and roll with those ones. But when it's really persistent and disruptive, maybe a bit drunk, then, you know, you sort of have to deal with it or stop the gig. Right. Or I don't know, like, I don't, you know, there are one gig I had to stop altogether, but I do sort of that. I kind of just go to like a nice place with them. I'm like, hey, I don't know what, like, I'm not the kind of comic that's like, you know, those like movie, those clips that you've seen on YouTube of like comedian destroys heckler. Like, I'm the version of like heckler destroys comedian. Like, this is not gonna, like, I don't have anything clever to say to you right now, except like, hello, sir, like, please stop.
Oh, yeah.
And just kind of like,
so you just defang them.
Kill them with kindness. Yeah. And I don't know what the point of that story was.
Well, I guess we were kind of just getting back to talking about the menu and Nicholas Holt having to get up and
The
cook,
pleasure of seeing someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there has, but sometimes I mean, look, kill them with kindness. But the other thing that I do is like, hey, like, and just sort of stop and look at them and sort of like put the pressure on them. Be like, and have like say things like, do you want to go? Do you want to?
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think that's pretty delicious. So I'll tell you what was said to me before I saw the menu, which then made me, I was a bit bamboozled because I know a few people who saw it who didn't like it at all. And the common thing they said was, really early on, I worked out what was going to happen. And I was like, oh, I never at any point thought that the movie was something to work out. I was just happy to sit there and watch it happen. I worked it out too, but it's fine.
There is a strange thing where people, it's like there's actually only a very narrow band of art where one of the, you know, screen stuff where the main goal is to like
be ahead of it.
Well, yeah, like keep everyone guessing and on their toes until the last minute. It's kind of like, it's like, you know, Knives Out, Glass Onion, which is more of the Eat the Rich stuff, by the way.
Yes, but yeah, yes.
Knives Out, Glass Onion.
I got up a little list for you.
Thank you.
Because of what you said. So, because I thought it might help for people listening. Parasite.
Yes, Parasite was and maybe one of the first ones that really kicked off this trend. I feel like a lot of people.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Would have looked at that film executives. I mean, 2019. And gone, make us like that.
Triangle of Sadness, which I was going to get to on the weekend, but I still haven't managed to get to yet. Yep. Knives Out is mentioned. It's the original one, but it can also mention the sequel. Snowpiercer.
Yep, Snowpiercer. And the TV series as well.
Hustlers. Have you ever seen Hustlers?
Never.
I have heard just the best.
Oh, wait. Was
with
that the
Jennifer Lopez?
Oh, okay, no, it's slightly different. I'm thinking of American Hustlers.
The other one, Us by Jordan Peele.
Yep.
And The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I really enjoyed, and Joker, which I was not into.
Yeah.
But anyway, that just gives people a bit of an idea of those kinds of movies.
This is what we're talking about when we talk about that trend in cinema and things.
But anyway, The Menu was just one of those movies that I just enjoyed. I enjoyed the performances. I love Hong Chow. I thought she was great.
Yep.
Anya Taylor-Joy was great. Nicholas Holt is just always kind of magnificent. And I really love Ralph Fiennes. I just enjoyed all the performances. And I thought the denouement was, I don't know, wanting the burger. And eating the burger at the end was kind of fun. I found it fun.
It was cute. It was cute.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
It's a movie I might watch again.
Huh. There you go.
I don't know if I'd go out of my way to watch it. But if I was... Say it's one of those nights where you've been flicking around for 20 minutes and you just don't know what you're in the mood for. You think, you know what, fuck it, I'll watch The Menu again.
Fuck it, just to end this like endless decision making.
And I'll be pretty happy with that decision.
Yeah, look, I would almost go back and watch it just out of curiosity because I can't fault the performances. The performances were extraordinary. It was a little bit like, you know, seeing Ana de Armas in Blonde, right? It's like, you just did a spectacular job with a film that arguably...
I feel like that, sir.
Shouldn't have been made. No. But The Menu should have been made. I'm not saying like it was that bad. I'm not saying as bad. It's not like on the Razzies list, but I just was like frustrated. I'm like, I just wish you guys had taken another couple of passes at that script. Easy for me to say. It's like, I feel like,
Well, you know, it's, you're allowed to be critical. Do you know what I mean? Like,
thank God.
But while also acknowledging that, you know, I had Melanie Tate on, who has one of her plays being made into a movie, and we were discussing how anything gets made, let alone gets made well, is like quite shocking.
Yeah, I think speaking of like our six month run up to this, I had a thought at some point in the last 2 years that the amount of time it had taken for a certain project to come to fruition, that I had aged visibly in that time.
Right.
And now I can't stop thinking about that metric, particularly when you work in like project-based creative projects and you're like, oh, by the time – and film is so devilish as well, like in that way. And like, you know, if you have ambition to like make a TV show or make a film project and you're at the start of your career, you're like –
yeah.
I wonder how much older I'm going to look by the time this gets made. Not that yeah. that, but just as a metric, not yeah. because like aging is Satan or anything.
You know,
but.
You know, one of the things I will always appreciate about the Breaking Bad universe is they made a movie many years after the TV series finished, and the actors were both a bit chubbier. And you know what? It was fine. And you know what? Better Call Saul, for the most part, takes place before Breaking Bad. But Bob Odenkirk, that like he's quite clearly older. But you yeah. know what? It's fine. We get it. It's not a documentary.
Trust your audience to forgive
yeah, it's
that
fine.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would also – I'm now at a point I've made a decision this year that I would rather see something like The Menu and think that maybe it doesn't quite land the plane than another By the Numbers – IP movie.
Oh,
so
yeah.
you know, like I saw Avatar, times,
yeah.
which technically is a really well-made film. Like I totally get it. Like I can see the expertise and I can see the attention to detail and the care that's been put into that film. And it's so much better than the movie. It's so much better than the movie I'm about to mention. But I saw Babylon and I had a much better time and that is a hot mess. Mm. That movie is a hot mess and I had a really good time and I laughed and even the shit that didn't work made me laugh and I kind of appreciated its excess and they're both, you know, 3-hour movies and Avatar is technically a better movie and I was bored shitless.
It's such a relief to hear you say that. And it does make me wonder, like, where are the people? Where are the hordes of people who are crying out for Hollywood to continually dive into these same pools of IP again yeah. and again and again? I mean, they must exist because these films do relatively well at the box office. Is it because of a lack of alternative? I don't know. I have been really stuck for about 12 months now on the question of this kind of what, you know, people have written, like there's a lot of capital D discourse about this, about, you know, the creative crisis yep. has a name, the creative yep. crisis that we are not seeing. And, you know, studios like A24 making films like Everything Ever All at Once is seen as a departure from that. They're yep. very welcome one and that yep. perhaps we might be starting to move away from that. I have my own personal theory as to why we're really hooked on nostalgia as a culture, because it's very prominent in screen culture, but it's visible elsewhere as well, particularly in, I think you can see it in music as well, mm-hmm. just this kind of stalling, looping. I have a theory that it is because we don't have so much a monoculture anymore because audiences are incredibly fragmented mm-hmm. and we stopped having a kind of common cultural canon. We sort of hit pause on that. There wasn't mm-hmm. an exact moment, but if I had to gun to my head, pin it down, I would say like 2010. Mm-hmm. About 2010 is when everyone stopped looking at, listening to, consuming reliably the same thing to the point that we could all refer to it reliably yeah. and know that everyone else will be on board.
Yeah.
It stopped happening. And so I think, you know, the commercial imperative didn't go away for Hollywood to continue to achieve those numbers, particularly with yep. those big blockbusters where you have all that expenditure. And so what they've done is gone, okay, what is the reliable way to get people, get bums on seats, get people back, you know, into the cinema to see this thing? Talk to them about the last thing that we know they all remember, which is like pre-2010, hence the nostalgia
right.
loop.
Well, that's also why certain things pop, you know. It's like I was talking to a comedian recently who said that he won't do any material about the Queen dying because he thinks it's hack. And it's like I was fascinated by that because I didn't think it was hack at all. Mm. I think it was one of those rare things that we're all across.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why wouldn't you talk about it?
Yeah.
You know, like you can approach it in a hack way, but if you've got thoughts on it. But I think that, and also I think there has been, I think you, like I like that theory. I also wonder if, I think mainstream entertainment has been dumbed down to such an extent that people would rather watch something they're not really that into but know that it's fine than Like, I watched seven different couples leave Babylon.
Hmm.
And it's like, well, why are you leaving? Like, can't you, like, it's, there's so much happening in this film. Can't you just kind of sit back and watch? Like, can't you?
I'm not across the film. Does it, is the content the kind of thing that would make people uncomfortable, or is it just of a low quality?
Oh, it's like, no, it's Damien Chazelle. Like, it's like a beautiful looking film, and it's, and it's about the movie industry with the talkies, silent films becoming talk films.
Right, yes.
But, you know, like the first,
I have seen a trailer. Yeah.
Like 5 minutes into the film, an elephant shits all over two people. Huh? And it's really, like, if you can't just kind of, like, it's funny.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's the tone. Like, that sets the tone.
Yeah, that's kind of letting you know. Like, and everything's maximalist. Here's what you're in for. Yeah. Like, even the silence is dialed up to 10.
Wow.
But I know people, like, I know a mate of mine hated Thor Love and Thunder and has watched it 3 times.
What's that? Have you how does your friend explain that?
It was shit. I've watched it a few times, and it's not great, and I thought it might get better, but it hasn't. But they would, so, and then you say, oh, you should see Tar. Oh, I'm not seeing that. A 2 hour 45 minute movie,
okay,
so about a conductor, and you go, you watched a movie that you hated the first time 2 more times for what?
This is the other ingredient in the kind of explanation for why people are really gravitating towards nostalgia at the moment. And it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, sneered at sometimes as like the pop psychology explanation, but it's incredibly real as well. It's that people don't want to be challenged at the moment. I remember pitching a really kind of, I mean, you know, I love dystopian stuff. I'm a little bit burnt out on it. But, you know, about 18 months ago, pitching something to a content executive at a media company, being like, I want to make a podcast about all the different ways that the world could end, mm-hmm. ranking them from like least likely to most likely, mm-hmm. and kind of going through what we're doing. You know, just like, turning those ideas over. Super interesting. There are a lot of ways the world could end. That's something that I am excited about. And he said to me, I think we're moving into a time where people are just going to want to tune out from hard shit. And
yes,
people are and we know that because, I mean, the ratings for a lot of like news and current affairs content over the last 18 or so months has, you know, not been good. It's kind of tanked. And that's not like one outlet. That's an across the board pattern. People are switched off, and if something's hard, if something's challenging, and I get it.
Mm.
People do not want that. They want, like, it's like Weimar Germany is what he was saying. They just want to like forget the war, forget the reparations, forget like, you know, draw some stocking seams on our calves and go out dancing and like watch some like dumb nothing that doesn't mean anything.
Right. But not engaging with the news shouldn't mean not engaging with your intellect.
No. Tar, as an example, to go back to your example, Tar is like potentially a challenging film. It is, you know, it's kind of being marketed as such. It's like is this like a treatise on cancel culture? I mean, we'll leave that to one side because I've not seen it yet, and people will have that debate elsewhere. But, you know, it promises to deal with serious themes.
Right.
Thor, not promising to deal with serious themes. It's escapism.
Yeah, but why would you? What?
So
if I got kicked in the cock and it hurt, I don't need to be kicked in the cock 2 more times just to see if it still hurts.
No, I can't explain a friend's behavior any more than you can. Seeing if that film 3 times doesn't make any sense to me. But I think there is, what I would say is that there is comfort in the familiar.
Yes,
and that, can be, so sorry, to extend on the point, you know, what I meant when I was like, people want the easy thing, people don't want the hard thing. That also encompasses seeing the familiar thing.
Yes.
People want to the thing that they remember from when they were a kid, the song that they will remember from being a teenager, or maybe that's even just a film they've seen before. Even if that film is shit, you know what you're in for, and the world is kind of a little bit unpredictable right now.
Yeah.
That is the understatement of the century. And you know what's predictable? The shit film I watched last week.
Yeah. No. I think you're right. But, you know, if you go to Babylon and you just can't enjoy, even on a very simplistic level, Margot Robbie in a dress, then
sure,
like, What, you couldn't sit in air conditioning for 3 hours and just enjoy Margot Robbie? Like, you couldn't enjoy... Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Are you... I just think... Okay, so this is a...
And I need to stress, the movie is a hot mess.
I can't... You've sold it. Like, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
What I would say, and this has just reminded me of something that I've been thinking about a bit, because for the last 2 days, all I've been listening to is classical music.
Okay,
yes. Which happens to me sometimes when, like, it is a little bit challenging inside my brain. And I've been thinking about why that is, like why, and it's about having a strong aversion. I was thinking about why we have such a strong aversion to certain media at moments. And I don't know if you have this, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking of the people who walked out of Babylon here for whatever reason, where they're just like, I can't sit. I know it's air conditioned. I know Margot Robbie's in a dress. Mm. I cannot sit here for the next 2 hours and 55 minutes. I can't do it. I can't do it. And you have to leave. And that seems like quite an extreme move, but and it would be rare for me to do that with a film, but I do that with music. Right. I have incredibly strong aversions to music, and it's not you know, the same song all the time. It's based on my mood. I'm like, I need my mood to be underscored in the correct way. I need the activity I'm doing to be underscored in the correct way.
Yeah.
And you know, like if you're like having a romantic time, like having, and you're like, you feel like you're in love with someone and you're having like this very profound moment with them, having like a silly song or a funny song in the background becomes like unbearable because it is like, it's undermining the seriousness of the moment that you're having. Or if you're incredibly sad and some like upbeat pop song comes on, it's the same thing, you know. Or, and then lately all I've been able, I just like can't tolerate anything but like this. You know, I was listening to like Dvorak on the way here, and I'm like, great. And it's the only thing, but it's so dramatic. And I'm like, what is it about this? And it's like, it's music to like murder or be murdered to. Like it is, it's incredibly dramatic. So it's not necessarily free of stress.
Yeah.
But I do, I guess I can relate. I have strong, very strong reactions to certain kinds of media at times. I'm just like, I can't look at this. I can't hear this, whatever it is.
I definitely get that.
What's the last thing you had like a strong aversion to and you're like, I simply cannot?
I pushed myself through it, actually. I made the terrible mistake. I'm not saying this has got actually nothing to do with the quality of the film. It was just the wrong film
for
the moment. And Antichrist, the Lars von Trier film.
I've not seen it, but yes.
Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsborough, and I just was about halfway through it going, oh no, like what have I done? Like over the course of 3 days, I'd watched All Quiet on the Western Front, Babylon and Tar, and I was like, you know what, tonight I should have watched The Menu again. Do you know what I mean? Like that was the mood I was in. Here's a scene I like. Oh, here's an actor I like. Yeah. Instead, I watched this very confronting film dealing about a couple in a cabin trying to deal with the grief of their child dying and all the terrible things that happen physically and perhaps supernaturally as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And about halfway through, I just decided, you know what I need to do to even this shit out? I need to eat some ice cream. I pressed pause and I ate some ice cream for about 10 minutes and then went, right, okay, let's get back to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do sometimes need to take breaks. I do need to sometimes hit pause to be like, I'm so stressed out. Do you get like stressed out enough that you need to like pause things and be like, hold on a tick?
Yeah, I just need to, and that's, you know, like, that's why I prefer the cinema experience, because you can't escape even though you might be but I kind of, because I think it's a safe place to experience those feelings. But you know, I've been watching on HBO The Last of Us, which is the Pedro Pascal series based on the video game. I have no idea about the video game, but I've really enjoyed the first two episodes of the series. And but you know, like, that's, it's not necessarily a happy joy watch. So then immediately afterwards I'm watching season two of Reservation Dogs. You know, and it's just like a little palate cleanser before I go to bed.
Have you ever hit pause because you were laughing so hard?
I don't think so. Like, I've laughed pretty hard. Is this a sneaky little segue into White Lotus?
I wanted to... No, not... To, well, that, but also... Yes.
I can... But that is actually... So we might as well get to it, right? And once again, spoilers for anyone who hasn't watched season two of White Lotus. And this, so turn off now.
This podcast's been riddled with spoilers.
It's been riddled. Yeah. But I loved Tanya so much all the way through that series. And the kaplunk that happened, because I was sitting there and she's in those... She's freaking out and she's in those shoes.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, just go down the stairs. Just go down those steps and you'll be right. And when she said, you got this, and she hit. But it also weirdly, one of the kind of best noises I've ever heard in a film.
I was so jealous of the Foley guy.
Well,
whoever the Foley, like whoever the sound design guy is.
The two sound design people I want to get to, I want to hear a podcast with, is the person who designed Tanya's Thunk.
Yes.
And the person who, have you seen Tenet?
No.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So, someone hits a beam in that.
Yeah, gotcha.
And I would like them to discuss the different kaplunk noises they came to, because it was
the equivalent
something
of the
about
Wilhelm
it.
Scream, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's gotta be one.
There was something about it.
So good.
And I was genuinely, oh no. But I could not stop laughing for the rest of the series. And I think my mum, because mum had already seen it, and I think she was like, why, like, you're laughing hard at this. And I said, because it's just something.
Yeah.
Like, because it was almost like a good joke. I think the best jokes are the ones that the audience is thinking of as you say it. Do you know what I mean?
Because, like, there's something satisfying about having your expectations
met. Yeah, and you get there just as you're saying it, they're thinking it, and then they're like, ah. Oh, do you know? Because sometimes if a joke comes from too left of centre, you can leave the audience going, what?
Yeah.
But if you can sort of say, if you can build it up and say it as they're thinking it, and then they go, yeah, and it's kind of... like, it kind of gives them confidence. And I felt like with that, I was like, geez, I wish she'd just go, oh.
Yeah. I think there's something to that about people needing the expectation. But I do like to be kind of sideswiped by a joke. Like, I think, like, that's just a personal taste. I know that is not, like, ordinary in audiences, but I really like to be, like, shocked by the punchline. And I was... there was something shocking about that. Like, it had a little bit of everything for everybody. But I had to pause it. It's not the... I was actually also thinking of the scene in Russian Doll, because this got me thinking, right?
I haven't seen Russian Doll.
Okay. Ah. Oh.
No, I know.
Ah. Oh.
I know.
Okay. It got me thinking about what makes a death funny.
Right.
Because it was in some ways quite a disrespectful death to give to a main character. Because, like, she was...
also, because Mike White, that's like Jennifer Coolidge is like his best friend. And he created that character for her. And he killed her off with, like...
Because we have this idea of, like, a good death and a bad death, right?
Right.
And by some metrics, Jennifer Coolidge's death on White Lotus was a terrible death. It was a bad death. If that was a drama, that was the most disrespectful death you could possibly give a character. Yeah. I mean, like, yes, afterwards you got the lingering shot of her sort of floating in the water, and you got, like, this sort of moment of poetry with the corpse, which, you know, lent a little bit of belated respect to the whole affair of her incredibly untimely death.
Yeah.
But but then when you think about it, okay, so it's a dramedy, right? Like, it's a drama, it's comedy. And I was thinking about the way that show had been carved up and how they've actually done it in an interesting way where not everyone, not every plot and not every character in that series is both funny and dramatic.
Right.
Some characters are just funny. Some characters are just dramatic.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm simplifying here, and you could argue the toss, but I think, you know, I'm just trying to, like, set out a thesis here. Jennifer Coolidge, funny pretty much 1,000% of the time.
Oh, and like, even when she's trying to, like, her choices. Her
eating spaghetti?
Eating spaghetti. Like, her choices of, like, you know, the quick little steps she makes when she wants to get to the other side of the boat to make a call. Even the way she murders everyone with the gun, with her eyes closed and crying. Like, it's all of her choices. But even
so funny.
Even the way she looks at her assistant and is aghast when she's in places that she's not meant to be.
And when she whispers the word gypsy.
Oh, my, like, God.
Just all of
all those choices.
And for a comic character, there is no better death. than the death that Jennifer Coolidge got. This is what I'm getting to. It is a highly respectful death for someone who is like hard out funny to be like, what's the funniest way we can kill this person? Also, okay, so now I've got like all these theories that I'm fermenting about like what makes a death funny. The sound, very funny.
Sound is imperative.
Distance, funny.
Oh, yeah, we weren't up close.
You're not up close. Yes. You see it from a distance. Why? I don't know. Yep. Death, funny from a distance. Remember Monty Python, there's a sketch where everyone blows up at the beginning of, I think, and now for something completely different.
Yeah.
There's all these just random explosions that happen and people die in explosions for no reason.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so funny as a kid. I still think that's funny.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that and like that would have been, if the battery hadn't been dead on the remote, a great time for me to pause so I could piss myself laughing and not miss any more explosions. So I could play it back to laughing at the explosions because they happen from a distance.
Yeah. Well, you know what also works on the flip side emotionally is seeing something incredibly intimate from a distance.
Yes.
Because it makes you feel awful because you're seeing something that you're not meant to see.
Right, the voyeur thing.
So I wonder if there is a bit of that as well, or
I think it's...
It makes it maybe a little bit more impersonal. It's even impersonal, though, you know?
They're not funny. It becomes slapstick from a distance.
Yeah.
Like, it's in direct correlation to how far away you are from the death. And it was, like, pretty much like a... It was a wide shot of Jennifer Coolidge falling off that boat. But I'm not ruining anything when I tell you that there are some incredibly funny deaths in Russian Doll.
Right.
That is like, that was like, that's kind of, that's the most I've ever laughed, maybe besides Monty Python, at like that much death.
Yeah.
It just makes a total mockery of the whole affair.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly liberating. We want to be able to laugh at death.
Yeah.
Like how powerful to be able to laugh at death.
Well, you know, so I was just racking my brain for something else that fits in with what you're saying. And another death that you see from a distance, which is actually awful, but in the cinema everyone laughed, was in Pulp Fiction when they go over the bump and he shoots shoots Marvin.
That's actually on my list because I'm making a list of funny deaths.
And you see that from a distance behind the car and you just see and it's
so
also
right.
the noise of the like,
yeah.
And then it comes back to them going, oh, man, just shot Marvin in the face or something along those
lines. Yeah. And the sound, what's interesting about the sound is because it's counterintuitive that by making it realer, by making it more visceral, more like readily experienced, that would make it more funny. You'd think that would make it more shocking, more, you know, you feel the death more intensely. But no, like making it realer makes it funnier somehow. Yeah. The really funny bit, though, like what makes that Pulp Fiction death funny is John Travolta's line afterwards, right? Which is like it's like he's dropped his dropped his cheeseburger.
Yeah,
it's like Royale with cheese. It's like he's like, oh man, I just killed the Marvin or whatever. Like, it's the total casual, the cheapness of life should be very upsetting, very funny.
Yep.
I'm still trying to get to the bottom of it.
Have you seen Out of Sight?
No.
You
can spoil it for me, though.
There's a pretty funny death in that with a guy who's they're breaking into a house and he's and there's kind of two factions of people breaking into the house, and one of them is his character's called White Boy Bob, and he finds all these frozen dinners and steaks, so he's trying to steal them as well, and when he's running up steps, he slips and gun hits him and blows his head off, and it happens so quickly, and
getting killed doing something petty also very funny.
That's really funny.
Being petty, it's funny because I kind of threw it open to a couple of my like WhatsApp group chats when I started mulling this idea of what makes a death funny on screen, and there was someone who a good friend of mine who suggested, and I can't. Okay, this kind of sucks because I can't remember the name of the film, but it's like a detective who gets far too close. Maybe it's Brad Pitt, and he gets altogether too close to a murder, and then it turns out it's his wife in the box. This is in the 90s. His wife in the box, and then like the murderers. It's Kevin Spacey.
Oh, Seven.
Seven.
Yeah.
The death at the end of Seven, and my friend Tam just thought it was the funniest thing in the world that Kevin Spacey had put Brad Pitt's wife in a box, and that reveal, because it, and perhaps because it was self-serious. I mean, the difference there is that the creators of that film had not intended the death to be funny. That was an unintentionally funny
death. That is genuinely the weirdest response I've ever heard to that ending.
It was funny.
Like, hang on. When did Tam see the film?
I would say probably not at the time. She would have seen it when she was a bit older, and perhaps it has dated a little poorly because it is,
because people don't like Gwyneth Paltrow and people don't like Kevin Spacey.
Maybe no, I don't know. Also, become a cultural thing. I don't know that it was post him being cancelled. I actually think that film has. Audiences have become a lot more sophisticated in the last 15 years in the way that they, general audiences, I mean, in the way that they consume screen culture, and they are a little bit allergic to tropes, and that is a very trope-heavy film.
Sure.
You don't agree?
No.
Go on.
I think it's a trope creator.
Well, okay, but that's the same thing,
isn't it?
But
that's also like people watching Pulp Fiction and going, ugh.
Yeah.
All the storylines were all jumbled up.
Yeah, no, it's... You just got to it late.
Yeah.
And that's actually, like, yeah. That was a, yeah. a new I thing. Rightly or wrongly, like, I'm not saying, like, oh, Seven was hack.
Yeah.
No pun intended. Seven was, like, you know, a badly made film. It's like, it just scans poorly to a contemporary audience because they're like, oh, that's so done. It happened to be the first, maybe one of the first films that did that.
It set off a whole list of those types of movies. But at the time, I saw that at the cinema and had no idea that was coming. And the cinema was fucking...
in pieces.
Oh, just in shock.
Yeah.
Everyone was like... But I think it... what's in the box, yeah. like, it. Classic movies have things that get caught up in the zeitgeist, and then, you know, like, you had no idea her head was in the box.
I mean, I feel like, okay, so here's an interesting question, a very graphic one. This is going to get a content warning, but, like, would it have been a funny death? I would argue...
If it was a funny film?
No, if they showed the head in the box.
Which they don't.
Because it becomes... No, they don't. They make a choice not to, and that is obviously, that's how you keep... There's
a subliminal shot of her face.
You make death. That goes to my point before about, like, the closer you get to a death, counterintuitively, the funnier it gets, because the more ridiculous it gets, because we don't have the tools to kind of compute death when it becomes too real.
Yeah,
that needs to be treated with a respectful, almost funereal, approach where, you know, shots are respectful and distant and lingering.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see their face and we see the pain and we see the emotion on the loved ones as they, you know, their person dies and the fear in their eyes as they die. It gives the due respect to the sacrament of death.
Yes.
But if you go too close, if you get too real, all of a sudden... passes out the other side of being respectful and tragic, and starts being funny again.
The thing about the ending of Seven is, and I want people to listen to this carefully before they judge what I'm saying, but the head in the box is not what you're getting to. It's about the character making the choice when they discover what's in the box.
Yes.
It's about the choice that has to be made. And if you've been engaged with the film, you're hoping that they make the right choice.
Yes. I love that you're protecting this spoiler, even though...
No. Oh, well, you're hoping that Brad Pitt's character, who has been shown to be impetuous and all the way through it has been mentored by Somerset, who's trying to, you know, get his naivety out of him and stop him from being, you know, he's...
A hothead.
He's a hothead and he's a bit of a machismo boy and all of that kind of stuff. And then you're hoping that by this stage that he's learnt the lessons and in the end he... succumbs to who he really is.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the movie's about when your faith has been worn down and you decide to... It's the right thing to do is to keep on, which is what Somerset decides to do.
Mm.
I would say a funnier death with Brad Pitt in it is in Burn After Reading.
Right. You'll need to refresh me. I have seen this, though.
So George Clooney, is in one part of the storyline, Brad Pitt's in another part of the storyline, and for the whole movie, and Clooney's character is a fucking flog of a human being. He's awful. And Brad Pitt's a fucking idiot.
And we are intended to...
Yeah, great. Clooney's character's fucking... Like it's hilarious.
They're awful. A nightmare. Yes, this is ringing a bell.
He's an awful arsehole. Yep. And Brad Pitt's character's a fucking gym idiot. And the whole movie, you're sitting there going, I can't wait to see these two characters meet. And then... when they meet for half a second because Brad Pitt's hiding in George Clooney's cupboard and Clooney shoots him in the face.
Yeah.
And you're like sitting there going, I've been waiting for them to meet for the whole movie. And he just shot Pitt in the face.
This one falls firmly under the category of like prank on the audience.
Yes.
Funny because it's like fucking with the audience and their expectations. Like people... Yeah. You know, it's like, you got us.
Yeah.
Like, ah.
Tell you what, though, I'm dying to meet Tam. Like, I'm...
I mean...
Like, I am genuinely... Like, by the way, I'm kind of... I feel like I'm standing up for Seven way too much, but it's... but I do think, in my 1996 Bunta Boy show, Happy as All Buggery, we had film stuff and we crossed... We did a parody of Seven, but we crossed it with Tim Ferguson's Don't Forget Your Toothbrush. And, if anyone who ever saw that show, Tim Ferguson and his team would break into your house and they would, you know, they'd offer you money or they'd have your teddy bear from when you were a kid ready to set it on fire or something like that. And so we had Tim Ferguson as Kevin Spacey saying to my Brad Pitt, you know, go on, open up the box, David. I went into your house. I got your favorite toy. What's in the box? Anyway, so that was 96.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's, I feel like it's lost its power. If we were making jokes about it in 96, it's a long time since then. So
arguably,
it's in the zeitgeist. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a soft spot for Gwyneth Paltrow as an actor. But everything else, I'm fine. Hey, just getting back to White Lotus quickly.
Yes.
We'll have to finish up in a sec. But who was your favourite character? Because I had a character who I was, to be completely honest, a little bit indifferent to begin with, and then they became my favourite character by the end.
Okay. I think there's my favourite character who I liked the most and just wanted to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... I mean, this may be, I mean, it's, you know, I love Jennifer Coolidge, but Lucia.
Yeah.
So good to see, her get up.
Yeah. Mike White was inspired by Laverne and Shirley for those characters. And it was great. What a fantastic ending.
Oh, and like her offsider, the piano player and the scene in the chapel. Mia, the scene in the chapel, like looking up and like getting like a, you know, crossing herself, going like, am I really going to blow this guy in there? Anyway.
Yeah.
But my very, very favorite character from just like a writer's perspective is the youngest of the family, the, you know, American Sicilian family who are there to meet their roots.
Yeah.
Albie.
Yep.
Thank you. Because he is the perfect portrayal of like, it was just such a insightful critique of like this, like, but done in a smart way of this kind of East Coast liberal who like thinks he's a feminist, but is like really just like sees women as like these fledgling things to be protected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is doing so from like, I thought it was just a really good portrait of the complexity of people who are doing their utmost to behave in, you know, a good way, to be a good person. And they think they're nailing it.
Yeah.
And
you're kind of
on their side because you're like, okay, you are trying to be what you understand a good person to be.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, but like you are so far off the mark, my dude.
Yeah.
And really kind of annoying at the same time, but making me laugh as well.
Yeah.
I loved that character because it had all that going on and that is hard to do.
I did love Albie as well for all his flaws.
Yes.
Because he was a good boy.
Specifically for his flaws. That is the only reason I loved him.
Yeah. But there is something very interesting in the person trying to be their best and thinking that they're doing a good job of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the end, three generations of men checked out that woman as she walked past.
Boy.
You know, so that was great.
And she was a babe.
Like, yeah. You know, like I'm not judging it. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I loved Daphne. I just found Daphne to at the beginning to be like, oh, God, she's annoying. And then the further it went, I was like, no, she is the most interesting character here for me. She's the most complex.
Yep.
When she says, here's a picture of my gym instructor. This is a picture of your kid. And the way she's just like, yeah.
Yeah.
It was just such a beautiful performance, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And to see someone, again, like the complexity, like seeing someone kind of running dead on a lot of stuff, like playing dumb, and then like actually being like, oh, no, I have a plan for literally everything, and this is a very convenient situation for me, and I have made a lot of choices.
Yeah.
I am in control here.
There's that little moment where our husband right at the end is fucking flossing his teeth with anger, and she's like, hey, come and say hello to our son. And in that little moment of him flossing and the look on his face, you go, he knows that's not his kid and he's still playing the game as well. And then he comes out, hey, buddy.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is great. It was great. We should finish up. Are you doing the festivals this year? What's happening?
Yeah, I sure am. I'm doing two shows. One's a two-handed with Jane Watt called Jazz or A Bucket of Blood, which is exactly as silly as it sounds. There is a bucket of blood on stage throughout the show. And the other one is called...
Wait a minute. Should people sit in the front row?
Yes.
Okay, great. That's all. That's the only question I had for everyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wear your white dress, sit in the front row. Yeah.
I don't know about...
No, it's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
Okay.
Really, it's true.
I look forward to the emails from people. You said to wear the white dress and now it's red, pink all over.
I got it dry cleaned especially. And the other show that I'm doing is a new solo show, which is called Your Mother Chucks Rocks and Shells, which is rhyming slang for a very specific line in The Exorcist. If you know, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's it. So that, and that other one, Your Mother Chucks Rocks and Shells, is kind of about being stuck awake at 2 a.m. It's like a whole show where it's always 2 a.m. And surprise, surprise, about, you know, maybe like 50% of the show is about The Exorcist, but not the way you know it.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that okay to sit in the front row?
That one, yeah. No, we love it. Sit in the front row. Always sit in the front row.
And always great to see you. Where can people find you on the socials?
If you find me on Instagram, I think I might be the only Ange Lavoie-Pierre out there. Shouldn't say that. You'll find me though, Ange Lavoie-Pierre. That's where you'll be able to see upcoming details for my new podcast, and my seasons in Adelaide and Melbourne Comedy Festival and all the other places.
And your podcast got some nice mentions in some pretty big areas towards the end of last year.
Yeah, it was really lovely. Apple Podcasts listed us as one of the shows that captured the moment in 2022, which is really, you know, what we're trying to do. We're going like, okay, what are the things that people are obsessed with, and how the hell did it come to occupy so much real estate in our brains, in our collective consciousness?
Yep. That's great.
So yeah, that was really nice. That was a really nice thing. We've chosen Schmeitgeist as the name for that podcast because we just wanted it to be something for people to be easy to find.
Yeah.
And Schmeitgeist is so spellable.
Yes, it is, right? I'm not going to try. I'm just going to say goodbye now, and then I'm going to try and spell it without anyone listening in case I get it wrong. Thank you. Thank you to Ange for dropping by today. It was a real treat to finally be able to hang out with her again. Make sure you check out her shows at the Adelaide Fringe and Melbourne Comedy Festival. And while you're at it, if you're coming to my solo show, Little Victories, don't forget to use the promo code PODCAST to save money on your ticket purchases. Head to justinhamilton.com.au/gigs. Thank you also to Alicia for being our Patreon subscriber of the month. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, Alicia. If you'd like access to bonus podcasts, works in progress, scripts, bigger discounts to live events, etc., head to patreon.com/Justin Hamilton and you will find a tier that suits you. I will be back on Thursday And it is going to be the fabulous Adam, Richard and I discussing our favourite TV shows of 2022. And we're also discussing your favourite TV shows. Lots of the listeners, lots of the people who subscribe to Patreon and are part of the Big Squid universe shared their thoughts. And so Adam and I discussed them as well. And if you listen to the first favourites, the first podcast, sorry, that went up for this season, which was Favorite Movies of 2022 with Alexi Toliopoulos. If you listen to that, you know that Alexi and I agreed on one movie and it was in exactly the same space. So if you've missed that, go back and listen to that. There's a little bit more crossover in this one, but not much. There's still some big differences. So it makes for a really, really fun chat. So that will come out Thursday. And then when we get to that episode, I'll let you know what's going to be happening next week. Let's finish today's podcast with a quote from journalist Bob Woodward. "I think journalism gets measured by the quality of information it presents, not the drama or the pyrotechnics associated with us." I'd like to think that's still true. Until then.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.